good. I'm sorry, I don't even know what time of day it is, but welcome to Information Week Live for the week of February 14th, 2016. I'm Dave Wagner, filling in for the much more articulate Kurt Franklin. Kurt is taking a much-needed break this week, but we have a full house for you today. Joining me today is the senior editor at Dark Reading, though I prefer to call her the mistress of the dark, Sarah Peters. Thanks for joining us, Sarah.
My pleasure, Dave. Thanks for having me.
We also have Tom Claiborne, editor at large for Information Week. He is the expert of all things mobile. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Of course, Dave. Thank you.
Yeah. And lastly, but not least, we have VP of Event Content and Strategy, Brian Galluli. Thanks for coming, Brian.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
Thanks. Well, Brian, I'd like to start with you. You're here for a very special reason. You, among other duties, are part of our Information Week conference, and you are in charge of our Information Week Elite 100. Tell us what the big news is with the Elite 100 this week.
Yeah, the timing is perfect. Appreciate you having me on to talk about this. But for the first time in, I think it's 28 years, we are releasing the list of 100 companies of the Elite 100 ahead of our conference. The conference is not until May 2nd and 3rd in Las Vegas at the Four Seasons. And we decided let's release the list of 100 companies now so we can build some buzz about the companies themselves. A lot of the attendees who'd like to attend the event can see who's going to be there, talking about some of their innovative projects. And also we are going to get several of the folks who are in the Elite 100, the CIOs of those companies, to come speak at the event. So it was actually an idea recommended to us by one of our advisory board members, a CIO at a company in Canada, and said, you know, you should release it early and really promote it. And it's been great. We've had a lot of feedback from some of these companies. They're asking how they can tweet about it and what other ways they can promote the fact that they made the final list. And it's just been a lot of buzz.
Great. So, you know, I think a lot of people have heard of the Information Week Conference. A lot of people have heard of Interop, which is co-located with Information Week Conference. But if they don't know, tell us quickly just a little bit about the conference and why we think these awards are so important.
Sure. If they don't know, though, I think they've been in a cave for a while. But it's our marquee event every year. Information Week puts on a two-day conference highlighting the Elite 100 that we just mentioned. The Elite 100 is a list of companies that they submit, I think it starts back in September, submit their entries to be judged by the Information Week editors on innovation, imagination in IT, you know, how they're using their technologies to advance the business, create better customer experience and whatnot. And we, from those submissions, we whittle it down. Very difficult process, by the way, whittling it down to the top 100. And then we, as I said, we have the conference at in Las Vegas this year, where we have guest speakers from around the industry talking about the theme this year, which is how to build a world-class IT enterprise. And then we celebrate the award winners, the top 100 companies, especially the top 10 companies, at a gala dinner on the Tuesday of the conference. So that'd be May 3rd. So we do that. And then we have a number of other category winners, like best use of mobile technology, best use of security, best use of analytics, et cetera. So it's quite a combination of a great opportunity to learn a lot of new things at the conference and then also celebrate some really spectacular uses of technology the evening of the May 3rd.
Right. So I realize that we, you know, we have to wait to find out who the top 10 is, and there are going to be some special things that really we can only learn by showing up at the conference.
Mm-hmm.
But have you noticed some some themes or some lessons, some sort of broad conclusions you can draw about some of the things we can learn from the top 100? Have you noticed a trend or two that you can share with us?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things that really jumped out at us this year, a trend that jumped out, is a lot of the companies are leveraging analytics, predictive analytics or advanced analytics of some kind, to do more with the information they have, obviously, learn more about their customers and do a better job of marketing and selling to them. A lot of our top 100 companies have leveraged analytics this year. So that's one of the big ones. The other that I thought was pretty interesting is the use of open source. We had a lot of companies that have, you know, and just in terms of using open source technologies to more efficiently and a lot less expensively, implement and deploy their technologies. And a lot of them are going to open source sites like GitHub and the like to share their technology as well. So those two things, I think, are the biggest that jumped out at us. One of the things that I would say was a little surprising to us, and not in an entirely positive way, was in the area, and Tom might have some thoughts about this as well, but in the area of mobility, we did get, you know, a few very, very interesting examples of companies that have created new mobile apps or just some way to mobilize their workforce. But I was a little bit surprised that the dearth of really, really cutting-edge mobile technologies like wearables and the like. But that, I'd say those things are the biggest things that jumped out at us.
Well, I think that sounds great. If I wanted to know a little bit more about who made the top 100, if I understand correctly, the 100 is out, but not the order in which they won. Where would I go to find that?
Sure, that is correct. We do emphasize it's the 100 finalists, and we list in alphabetical order right now. On informationweek.com, there's a link to the conference itself, and then as you drill down, there's a page where we include the list, the 2016 Elite 100 list. And then, as you mentioned, we are going to announce the rankings of the companies at the conference itself.
Right.
And, of course,
now, I don't want to give
anything
away. I'm sorry, Brian, did you have something to say?
I was just going to say, if you're interested in attending the conference, you can go to the same part of the website.
Great. I don't want you to give anything away here, so if I'm asking something premature, feel free to tell me we got to wait for the big reveal. Do you have a sense of any of the speakers who are going to be at the event from the Elite 100, or is that something we're going to have to wait for until we know who won?
I wish we were doing this next week, because we are in the process right now of confirming speakers from the Elite 100. The due date is next Friday to have them on our agenda. They're the final five speakers that we're going to be adding to the agenda. But some of the other speakers that we do already know about and we're publicizing who are not necessarily part of the Elite 100 are we have an opening panel of five CIOs talking about sustaining innovation, and they're an incredible lineup of CIOs that include JPL, Avnet, FedEx Ground and FedEx Freight, University of Pennsylvania Health Systems, and Pfizer. So that's a terrific lineup right there. And then also our keynote speakers, opening and closing keynote speakers, Vivek Wadhwa, who is a Stanford professor, is going to be coming in to do our opening keynote to talk about advanced innovation, things like machine learning and AI and robotics and stuff like that, so what's on the horizon. And then our closing keynote, talking a little bit more actually about machine learning and how to use data to advance the business, looking over the horizon again, is the gentleman who heads up Baidu's AI lab in Silicon Valley. And Baidu, if people don't know the company, and they should, is I think it's the fourth largest company on the Internet, but it's basically what a lot of people refer to as China's Google. So very excited about those speakers, and many more to come.
Great. Well, it's interesting. We're talking about AI in the keynote, and you were talking about predictive analytics as one of the major trends of the Elite 100. Do you think we're going to see some people deploying AI next year in the Elite 100?
That's a great question. I hope so. I would say this. I've talked to Vivek Wadhwa a number of times about his presentation, and he says we very definitely already are on the path to AI. A lot of companies are, at least machine learning, the first step towards artificial intelligence. And I think because a lot of companies already are deploying those technologies, I think some of them will be confident enough to say, okay, we're ready to roll out and publicize what we're doing. And we might see those in next year's list of Elite 100 winners.
Great. Well, thank you. I know you've got to go. You've got many, many things to get ready for the conference. But before you go, could you just remind everybody who's listening one more time where they can find the Elite 100 information and where they can sign up if they want to attend the Information Week conference?
Sure. So you go to informationweek.com, and at the top there are a bunch of tabs of different categories. There's an Elite 100 tab and an Interop tab, and you can click on either of those, and takes you straight to the information about the conference and information about how to register.
Great. Well, thanks, guys. I hope everybody joins us at Information Week conference this year. I was fortunate enough to be there last year, and I really learned a lot and had a great time. So thank you, Brian, for joining us. We're looking forward to hearing more about those speakers. Maybe we'll have you next week to hear more about it.
That would be a great idea. I'd be happy to do it. And by the way, Dave, you do a terrific job at this, and since Kurt is not around, I would say you've got to take over from now on.
Okay. Thanks, Brian.
All right.
Have a great day.
Good talking to you. Thanks a lot.
So, Tom and Sarah, I'm sorry we kept you waiting through that, but I hope you're getting excited about Information Week conference and Elite 100. I know both of you will be there. Sarah is part of Interop as well. So there's a pretty big news story this week. Often we talk about two or three different stories in a week. This week I think we'll probably devote most of our time to one story. Tom, why don't you fill us in? You did a great story this week on Information Week. Fill us in on Apple versus the FBI.
Yeah, well, Apple has been asked to help the FBI crack the passcode of an iPhone that was used by one of the shooters in the San Bernardino killings back in December. And the FBI has been unable to get at the data on the phone, which it believes is potentially useful to it. And one of the things that makes the case really interesting is that it's asking Apple to help it unlock the phone, and Apple has said pretty consistently that it's unable to do that with its recent updates to its operating system that uses in its marketing and talks about how Apple, unlike other companies, sort of protects your data. And what the FBI is asking is not to have it crack the encryption; it's to disable the auto erase function that deletes the data on a phone after 10 incorrect password attempts. So what the FBI clearly wants to do is to conduct a brute force password attack. Presumably they think that the password length that was chosen by the assailant in this crime was too short to be very secure. And they think that if they're able to throw a bunch of passwords at it, they can guess it in a matter of hours or days or however long it is. And to do that, they need Apple's help to disable the security feature and also to provide them with a way to make their password guesses really quickly, because the Apple iOS operating system has a built-in delay to prevent this kind of attack. It makes you can only guess once every, I think it's 80 milliseconds, which sounds like it's pretty quick, but if you're trying to do millions of password combinations, it can very quickly take you weeks or months to go through all combinations, depending on the length of the actual passcode. And Apple is resisting this because it feels like it shouldn't have to build custom firmware, which is what it will take to do this, and install it on this phone, because the government wants them to. And the question for me that's very interesting is, to what extent should a third-party business be forced to act as an arm of law enforcement. And people have very different opinions on this.
Right. Well, I'm going to let you hold off there, and I'm going to see whether Sarah has an interesting answer to your question. Sarah, if I'm interested in security, as you are, should I be worried about the FBI asking Apple to do this? Is this onerous? Is this going to hurt Apple's business? Is this a complicated thing to ask them to do?
Well, you know, I should say, first of all, that my personal opinions, I tend to always fall on the side of wanting to protect privacy over security, but the way that this has been discussed, this particular incident has been discussed, I think has been mostly oversimplified, and Tom really did a great job of not oversimplifying it. Some of the things that have gotten, I think Tim Cook in his statement tried to oversimplify things by saying the U.S. has asked us for something we simply do not have and something we consider too dangerous to create. They have asked us to build a backdoor to the iPhone. And I think that that's a really irresponsible way of saying it, because really what they asked for is a firmware update that could be designed to work only on that specific phone. That's what they asked for, that would only work on that specific phone. And as Tom explained, would just help them get around some of the controls to allow the FBI to kind of help them crack into the phone. So it wouldn't work automatically on all iPhones. It would only work on that one. Now, if you're
on that model or on that phone?
On that specific phone, only the phone used by this person who was the San Bernardino shooter.
If I were Tim Cook and I created this for Apple, I would not be cracking every iPhone 5C. It would just be contained to that individual phone?
It would have a unique identifier for that specific handset. Now,
okay.
If you were concerned that an attacker could get their hands on this update, or that a untrustworthy government could, you know, reverse engineer this and reconfigure it so that it could be redesigned and be an update that could be put on somebody else's phone and maybe help them crack into a phone, perhaps without obtaining the correct warrants. Maybe that's your concern. Or maybe you think that this is going to set a dangerous precedent for the future. Those are, you know, legitimate concerns. But I think that if we say something like the government's asking us to create an encryption backdoor in the iPhone, I think that is overstating what they have asked for. And I think that if, you know, you can't look at it like that and try to equate this with some of the other requests that have been made by law enforcement and that they have been trying to get Congress passed. Those things are, you know, some of the things that that law enforcement has been pressuring Apple to do in the past and that has been trying to get Congress to pass are major privacy issues. This particular case, I don't think, is the same matter. I think this is one specific issue that is separate, you know, related, but not the same thing.
Right. Well, let me ask a question of both of you, but I'll start with Tom. So let's assume Sarah is correct, Tom, and Sarah is obviously very thoroughly researched and expert on this. Let's say Apple can make this for one phone. Now, excuse me. If the government has a warrant, they can search my house, and they can search my computer. If I live in an apartment and they have a warrant, they can make my landlord open the door for them, even when I'm not home. What's so bad about the government having a warrant and asking Apple to open this, or make it easier, not even open, make it easier for them to open this one phone on their own?
Right. Well, first of all, it's not going to be just one phone, because once they have the, you know, precedent to do this, I mean, as they've actually stated in the legal documents, there's, you know, several dozen other devices that have similarly stymied law enforcement. So pretty much every time this comes up, if there's not another way to get into the device, you know, this will be used. And the question, I mean, there are, you can certainly come up with scenarios where everyone would want to have the device opened and cracked. But you also have to, I mean, but that's not really, I think, as fruitful as looking at it from, you know, what the precedent is, because it's not just our government that will do this. It's every government. If, you know, China is Apple's biggest market. If China sees that the U.S. government has this capability, they will ask for this capability too, and they will get it. And because the, you know, networks don't respect borders, there's no reason why China couldn't, you know, force Apple to install something over the air to obtain information from an iPhone in a U.S., in the U.S., if there were some, you know, person of interest to Chinese authorities there. And, you know, to me, really, the salient question is, to what extent should third-party businesses be forced to comply, to act as an arm of law enforcement? Not because many companies choose to do so, and you can certainly think of many heinous people that you would want to put behind bars, and if you own a company, you would gladly help the government find them. But this isn't about choice. This is about a requirement, and essentially it's saying that every company works for the government when we want it to. And at least, you know, in the American tradition, there should be some separation and some, you know, rules that the government and then businesses and individuals have to provide. And if this is the case, that if every business ends up being essentially an arm of the government on demand, really the only choice for an individual who wants privacy is to use open source software and to install everything, you know, yourself, and to use your own encryption, because that's the only way they can do it. So I think it's a larger issue, and it's not as simple as just saying this one phone, it's okay.
I think so that to Dave's point, there already are laws in place about having to provide documents to courts. There's already e-discovery laws in place. There already are things, like you said, having your landlord to provide entry to, you know, let police into somebody's apartment. And while this is certainly bigger than that, because you're not one landlord in one building with, you know, maybe 100 residents in it, you're Apple with millions and millions of customers. It's the scale of the issue is not even remotely comparable. But this isn't, you know, it's not like we haven't asked third parties for documents before when it comes to the courts. It's not like we've just said, hey, we've never asked people for this stuff, to some degree, this stuff before. Now, because it involves telecommunications in some way, that's, I think, where we get into the quagmire. Because right now we are, and rightly so, very nervous and very touchy about how our telecommunications are being surveilled because of so many grievous and egregious oversteps by the government when it comes to surveillance. And they're paying for that now, and this is why this kind of they're getting this kind of pushback now. I just think that we need to be clear when we are looking at the two things. We need to be looking at them as they are and not just throwing them all into the same boat. And actually, right before we started this conversation, news broke that the Justice Department, let me try to get the exact quote, they said that, they said that Apple's refusal appears to be based on its concern for its business model and public brand marketing strategy. And, you know, that's the Justice Department saying that, but I did have a few sources within the tech industry who said some similar things, that this stance on this particular case by Apple was guided and partly motivated by marketing and by public image, and not entirely by, was at least to some degree not entirely a genuine interest in protecting the privacy of all individuals.
Right. Well, it's fascinating because if you go in the Wayback Machine, you can find instances in the United States where generally the public would be calling on the government to protect them from businesses, right? That the government is more trusted with the privacy of an individual than a corporation, because the corporation's only interest is in the dollar. What's fascinating to me is, because of the Patriot Act and because of gathering the amount of data that the government is gathering without permission, we're now asking, or some people are asking, a corporation to protect us from our government, which seems like a sort of frightening prospect, that if I have to choose between a company that's beholden to its shareholders or a government which seems to be beholden to no one, that doesn't seem to be that great.
No, I mean, I completely agree with you, David. Like I was saying in the beginning, I am of the opinion that I frankly don't trust any of them. And I am always of the opinion that we, particularly over the past 15 to 20 years, have been very quick to allow our liberties, our privacy, and those related liberties to be taken away in the interest of security. And I'm very sensitive to this. It's an issue that I've been following very closely, particularly since I started working for Dark Reading again. And I think that I don't trust Apple because they have way too much. I don't trust Google because they have way too much. I don't trust the government, and I don't trust the NSA with all of this data. And honestly, think about how much, you think about how much data is being collected, how much of it is being used for marketing purposes, and how much of it is being analyzed and not just to feed you targeted ads, so that when you move from machine to machine to machine, suddenly you're getting the same ads on one, on a machine you've never even logged into before, that you are when you log into the machine that you have at home, and you think to yourself, how do they even know who I am? That kind of stuff I find very unsettling. So this to me is just, one drop in the bucket, and that has nothing to do with government surveillance. That just has to do with corporate America and the way that money and technology works these days. So the whole thing is suspicious, but I think you're right that asking Apple to protect us from the government is either way, we're not in a really happy situation either, no matter who you're aligning yourself with. I don't know. Maybe you're better off just not to have any technology.
let me ask Tom a question here. If I were Apple, what I think I would do, I mean, let's say this. Let's say if I were Apple and I was forced to comply, right? If legally I just, in the end, I had to comply. Whether I would comply to begin with, I don't know. But assuming I did choose to comply, what I would do instead of what they're asking me to do is instead of writing a piece of software that helped them crack it, I think what I would do is say, okay, hand us the phone. We will get you the data. We will not tell you how we got the data.
Mm-hmm.
We will hand you the data and the phone back and give you no information whatsoever on how this was done. Here it is, and we will do that only when you have a warrant. This way, they will have to do more work because there are going to be an awful lot of warrants suddenly, but they're not handing over any technology or any – they're not being compelled to do anything over the air, which is one of the things you were worried about. Do you think that would be a satisfactory solution to this problem, Tom, or am I opening up a different problem by doing that?
I think that completely ruins the trust model and the ability to sell security. I mean, if you want – I mean, Apple has gone to great lengths to distance itself from its major competitor, Google, which can't agree to the same kinds of protections as Apple because, in the end, it has to see, you know, the data from its customers in order to – provide it to, you know, in some form to advertisers.
Right,
Apple,
but can I sell that as a service? Let's say I discover the cure for cancer. I put it on my iPhone, but I'm such a muddle-headed professor. I can cure cancer, but I forgot my PIN number. And now the cure for cancer is stuck on that phone forever, and I can't figure out how to open it anymore. Wouldn't my ability to call Apple to help that, and it doesn't have to be that extreme, it just wouldn't it be nice
well,
for Apple to be able to open my phone for me if I forgot how to do it? Isn't that a service?
It is nice, and Apple actually, you know, in a way provides that option through, you know, if you use File Vault, which is their full disk encryption, you can choose to store the key with Apple, and that way if you ever forget it, Apple can decrypt your hard drive. You can also choose the option where Apple doesn't have the key, and then they basically warn you that you're screwed. If you forget that key, they can't get the data back just because, you know, encryption, you know, in a very closed system like that is pretty strong. I think ultimately Apple's, you know, best move is to find a way to give up the control that it clearly, you know, enjoys and get out of the business of making that decision. I mean, why should a company want that decision? And you know, more broadly, why should you know, everyone be required to sort of do the government's bidding, you know, upon demand? To me, it's very different if it's a choice than if it's a requirement. And I just think that, you know, as a business, what business does the government have, you know, telling you that?
Right.
Well, also,
my understanding
on
is. Oh, sure. Go ahead, Sarah.
Well, I was just going to add that to Tom's point, I agree with him that it really, to just be able to hand over the data itself would be more typical to a usual kind of, although it would be more typical to a usual kind of e-discovery request, Dave, it would violate a lot of their kind of promises about securing your data. The other thing is that to do that, really what Apple would have is a backdoor for themselves.
Right.
They wouldn't be giving the government a backdoor, but there would are, you know, there's a backdoor in iPhones, but it's just a backdoor for Apple, right? And what Apple and what Google, what Microsoft, what these cloud companies, what phone companies have been trying to do is take themselves out of this, get away from this problem entirely by moving to end-to-end encryption so that they cannot be asked to do exactly what you've just proposed, so that they cannot
right.
personally
right.
unencrypt that data.
Right.
So what government
well,
asked them is like the next
but
step.
But is that a promise that they were even allowed to make? Because my understanding is the DOJ is suing them on an act that was passed in 1789. And now you can argue that that's a little out of date.
Yeah.
But it's
I mean,
not
that,
like it came as a surprise to Apple or anybody else. that this law was on the books. Should they have just never made the promise to their customers that they can do this?
Well, it hasn't. I don't think it's been settled that it's illegal to make something that is, you know, investigation proof or encrypted or locked. And the, actually, another story coming out, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, that some senator was pushing a bill to make it essentially illegal to make a product that cannot be decrypted by the vendor, which essentially would end the ability to have encryption. I personally don't think that will end up going anywhere because it's such a sort of ridiculous concept, but there are a lot of people out there who just don't see that there's any value to security. And I mean, to me, really, the choice is either everybody has security or no one does. And you know,
there's battling bills out there right now.
You can have one.
Right. Well, I wish we could talk about this longer because I think that we've only scratched the surface of what is going to be a long and probably pretty heartfelt debate. And it's going to have long-standing precedent, I think, across the entire tech world. But at this point, we're running out of time. I just want to end with one question before we finish, which is, why is the phone more worthy of this kind of protection than my personal computer, just because the phone is better protected? And, you know, Tom, go ahead and start with that if you want.
I don't know that it is any more, you know, worthy or different than a personal computer, but it has other information like location data that's more sensitive. I mean, I think part of the issue here is that we have accepted a huge amount of sort of delegation in our activities to electronic devices without thinking about it. We, you know, regularly carry tracking devices. You know, does that mean that we've all affirmatively assented to being tracked all the time? I think a lot of people would balk at that idea. But that's really, you know, what we've done is we've all taken, you know, tracking devices with us in our pockets. And, you know, the notion that that information could be used against us, you know, seems far-fetched to some people, but it very easily can be. I mean, your location can be proven in many instances just by the way your phone pings off of cell towers. You know, we need to have, I think, a much, much deeper thought about, you know, what should be private and what shouldn't, and what the circumstances are in which that information should be, you know, required to be presented, and who should be involved.
Right. So can that genie be put back in the bottle, Sarah, or is it too late? Have we already given our tacit assent for this?
The optimist in me wants to believe that there's some way to back up a little bit. And I think that the pressure to start getting some control over privacy again in the U.S. is actually going to come from Europe. The fact that our data transfer agreement with them fell apart, and that we've got a new one that's hopefully going to make its way through the European Court of Justice and be approved. That all fell apart to begin with because of the U.S. really doing such a terrible job of protecting the privacy of U.S. citizens' data as well as European citizens' data. And now, over the past month or so, the U.S. is starting to make some efforts and some promises to get back on, to get on a better path, to try to make some strides or some token efforts to build faith with Europe again. I like to think that, as well as efforts being made within the technology, within the tech industry, will help push us in a different direction. I don't know if I'm just being too starry-eyed when I say that, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed that things will be a little bit better in the future.
Great. Well, I will keep my fingers crossed that we can keep having fantastic conversations like these on Information Week Live every week. If this is your first time tuning in, please join us every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern for Information Week Live. If you can't catch us live, you can find us at podcasts as well through iTunes and all the other purveyors of podcasts that you may enjoy. That leaves me to just thank my guests, Tom Claiborne and Sarah Peters, and earlier, Brian Galluli. As always, when we sign off, Tom, we ask you what you're working on for the coming week and how we can find you on social media. What can we look forward to?
Oh, well, the Mobile World Congress is coming up, and so I've got a couple of stories that I can't talk about because I've promised people I wouldn't talk about them. But there will be things about mobile phones in the near future.
Fantastic. Sarah, what are you working on? I know often security is very last-minute news-oriented. What can we count on from you, and how can we find you on social media?
I'm sort of in a similar boat because we've got the RSA conference coming up the week after next, so I'm kind of ramping up for that. Find me on social media on Twitter, at Sarah Peters, no H in Sarah. And just because he's not here today, just want to say that our usual host, Kurt Franklin, I don't know if he was involved, but there was some news that a Florida man was involved in some low-speed police chase after stealing a backhoe. So, sounds like it could be the kind of hijinks that Kurt is involved in. I could see him stealing
it
a backhoe.
It does. I do believe he's been doing some home renovation lately. So that's
it's true.
Well, in addition to finding us on podcast, you can bail Kurt Franklin out. we'll have a GoFundMe for Kurt's bail in another day or two. Well, thank you, Sarah and Tom, for a great show. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Please tune in next Friday to see if we pulled Kurt out of jail in time, or you'll have to put up with me again. Thank you for joining us on Information Week Live. See you next week.